Hello everyone, and welcome to Margaret Beaufort, Omnibus Edition number 6, comprising episodes 16 to 18. Just before we start, thank you so much everyone for your response to the anti-Nolan appeal. At the time of writing, we have over £5,000 worth of donations, which is just madness. Thank you so much. I will do those walks, come hell, or indeed, come high water. The 19th of June is looking a little dicey again at the time of writing due to a couple of hopefully short-term medical things, so I'm in a bit of a fug and a panic about that, but it will be done with accompanying Facebook Live videos about things of historical interest, which I have no doubt will fascinate you. Possibly. Right, so it seems that we have reached a sort of watershed in the life of our hero here. Just as my life can be divided into two distinct periods, before and after I won the under-12s tennis trophy for Quorn Tennis Club, so it feels as though Margaret's life can be divided into pre-Bosworth and post-Bosworth. Looking back, it is easy to see a clear dichotomy between the anxious, often wildly troubled life before her son became King Henry VII and the semi-regal life after it, where she was unassailable in her position. I hope that doesn't constitute a plot spoiler, by the way. But a word of warning. Although we know that Henry VII survived to found a Welsh dynasty that would rule England for over 100 years before the Scots picked up the baton, Henry and Margaret would have been none so sure. After all, Bosworth was just one more in a long line of battles and regime change that had bedevilled 15th century England. And so it would prove there would be another battle in 1487, for example. And after the Battle of Stoke Field that year, Margaret did not throw herself into a sofa next to Henry in front of an open fire, kick off her shoes and remark, "Well, great to see we've polished off the last battle of the Wars of the Roses then." And there would be further trouble before too long with Perkin Warbeck. The Cornish would revolt in 1497 and get jolly close to Westminster. Uncertainty and worry had not left Margaret's life, and, as John Fisher remarked, she was most definitely a person for whom every silver lining had its cloud. Or at least, she was more likely to worry than celebrate victory. Having said that, 1485 was a watershed for her, and it might be worth saying the obvious about why. Mums and sons don't always have super close relationships, of course, but often they do, and in this case, they had a relationship so close that its intensity feels almost slightly, I don't know, irritating a bit, hysterical almost. It might not have inevitably been that way, but look at it from each of their points of view. From Margaret's point of view, her whole life had been spent against the background of her only son's precarious present and very dodgy-looking future. As we've discussed many times over, she had worried, she had schemed, she had plotted. She had seen Henry stand on the brink of readmittance to society and seen him on the edge of the precipice of delivery into the hands of his potential murderers. We don't need to see this in the binary context of Henry being king or dead, for much of the time Margaret's aim was simply for her son to be admitted to his birthright and to live a full and productive life of which she could be part. We need to see this in the context of the strength of Margaret's family relationships, so she fought all life long for the best outcomes of her wider family, Beaufort, Wells, St. John. But from Henry's point of view also, there's the emotional thing, sure. Alongside Jasper Tudor, his mother had been the one constant thread of emotional and practical support since he was a nipper. But there's also a practical side to this. I have often said on the History of England, I think, that personal relationships between the king and his great families were the basis of effective rule. Incompetent rulers like Edward II and Henry VI were incompetent at least in part because they messed up patronage and personal relationships. They got the balance wrong. They didn't fully understand the nuances and the networks involved. Now, when Henry VII arrived as king in 1485, his assurance in dealing with the post-conflict settlement was notable. This included not only the obvious stuff like unwinding Richard III's titulus regis or visiting acts of attainder on Richard's supporters, but it also lay in bringing people together, in placating and encouraging traditional Yorkists who had supported Edward IV but were a bit equivocal about Richard III. How much of this settlement was due to Margaret and her council is the question I put to you. Margaret had been a part of the political scene in England at the highest level, frequently seen at court, now married to one of the very highest in the land, Thomas Stanley. We know that Henry honoured his mother and that she would be at court very frequently. How important it must have been for him to be able to lean on an intelligent and experienced political operator who knew the people and their families, and yet whose loyalty to Henry was without question that he could never rely on from any other kind of nobleman. Much of this we'll never know, I guess, in detail, conversations behind closed walls and that sort of thing. But we can be sure that Henry valued Margaret's counsel through their lives, that Margaret was unashamedly supreme at court. Nicola Tallis called her biography Uncrowned Queen, and as the story will unfold, that is a very accurate description indeed. Also, there are very interesting precedents in the 15th century. So, I give you Margaret of Anjou and Cecily Neville for examination by the jury. Similar to our hero, Margaret of Anjou became her son's greatest protector and supporter. With the incapacity of her husband Henry VI, she became the centre of effective power and rule under later Lancastrian rule. The analogy isn't perfect. Unlike Beaufort, the king was for a while completely incapable, and Margaret of Anjou therefore asked specifically for full regency powers. She also lost support for seeming to lack compassion by executing Yorkists who had previously been pardoned by Henry VI after the Battle of St Albans, the Second Battle of St Albans. Cecily Neville, however, mother of Edward IV, is a much closer parallel to Margaret. She had an even stronger reputation for piety. She was a commanding presence at court. Both Edward and Richard referred to her for counsel. She also had a reputation for being a terrier in defence of her landed rights. She was a generous benefactor to education, and she used her influence to exploit wardships and protect her tenants. Cecily is a very interesting parallel with Margaret, and maybe she and Margaret hit it off in the 1470s when they were both at court. Certainly, Cecily left a breviary browned with cloth of gold for Margaret in her will, and Cecil herself was honourably dealt with by Henry VII, although probably as much because she was the grandmother of his wife, as much from Margaret's intervention. Cecily was as staunch in her championing of the family of York as Margaret was for her son. Cecily famously left Henry VII a wheel of fortune in her will when she died in 1495, a reminder for him not to get too comfortable on that throne. Anyway, it is entirely possible that Cecily impressed Margaret with her example. Well, let's get back to the narrative then, and we can see how Margaret does react to the turn of fortune's wheel. After Bosworth in August 1485, Henry trogged off down to London, as you do if you're going to claim the country, and the London streets were, of course, packed with well-wishers. You didn't last long in London without knowing which side of your bread the butter was located. We don't know if Margaret met her 28-year-old lad there in London or on the way, but it must have been quite a reunion. I'm imagining, "You're right?" "Yeah, I'm all right." "You're all right?" "Cool." The lever of the one-armed bandit had been well and truly pulled for Margaret, and before Henry's coronation, the trust between mother and son was apparent. Margaret was given a vast house from which to base herself in London, Cold Harbour House, and was immediately entrusted with the guardianship of some critical people, namely Elizabeth Woodville, Elizabeth of York, the Yorkist candidate for the throne, the Earl of Warwick, Edward Stafford, the young Duke of Buckingham. But Margaret didn't spend all her time there in London. No, indeed, she must have spent some time in September 1485 at her old stamping ground at Woking, and with her son again. You might remember that in the happy days of Henry VI's second gasp, she'd had her son with her before he went off to Wales. Now, I do not know, but I would bet a pound to a penny, that Beaufort and Sons were as thick as thieves as the messengers and well-wishers came and went, and that the results of their fireside chats could be seen at the forthcoming coronation in Parliament. But the help that Henry's mother was able to give her son was practical as well as in terms of advice. So, as the king formed his own household, he was able to draw on a competent set of administrators in Margaret's household, over which she had kept stern control. So included in this was Reginald Bray, for example, Margaret's right-hand man, who went on quickly to work in Henry's service. Well, the coronation was, of course, as much a victory party as a coronation. The virtuous were front of stage at said post-match party, such as the ever-loyal Jasper Tudor, who, after a couple of decades of loyal service, finally cashed in his chips as Duke of Bedford, with marriage also to Catherine Woodville, and he was given the honour of carrying the crown. Thomas Stanley also found himself in receipt of goodies, although William Stanley, oddly, probably felt that although he had been rewarded, that couldn't be described as lavish, which is interesting. Margaret, of course, turned on the waterworks, and you'd had to have been made of stone not to have done the same had you been Margaret. When the king, her son, was crowned in all that great triumph and glory, she wept marvellously. At the following Parliament, from November to December, there was further redress for Henry's followers. But maybe we can also see the influence of his mother, or at least the strategy of a Cecily Neville rather than a Margaret of Anjou. For restoration was made to many who had suffered under Richard III, who were staunch Yorkists. Just as Margaret has suggested the idea of marrying Elizabeth of York to help bring Lancaster and York together, so she made sure that Henry's victory did not lead to a bloodbath. Margaret also played a part in this. For example, she found space in her household for one Ralph Biggard, a former knight of the body to Richard III. The Parliament did all the business stuff as well. Henry declared himself king by right, rather than king by conquest. Richard's titulus regis was repealed. But the other casher in of chips was, of course, Mum. And this was achieved in a rather remarkable way. My Lady the King's mother, as she was to be styled, was declared to be a femme sole. This was a quite remarkable move, and is worth describing briefly. In the medieval world, once married, a woman's legal status was described as a femme couverte. The origin of this seems to have been somewhere in the legal reforms of Henry II. The principle in law was that the husband and wife became one, which all sounds very equitable, does it not? But in practice, was of course absolutely not, because the single person concerned turned out to be the bloke, all the woman's goods. And a femme couverte could not own property, she could not sign legal documents, nor could she enter into a contract or keep a salary for herself. If she did earn a bob or two, she'd have to turn it over to hubby. But there was another legal status available for women, which was the femme sole. This was almost always seen as driven by economic reasons, very often adopted by widows or some single women in towns who were in control of a business and needed to exist legally, as it were, to be able to make contracts and all that sort of thing. Margaret's situation, though, was very non-standard. She was a married woman, for crying out loud. This was a social revelation, the kind of thing that makes Colonel Mustard spill his G&T with horror. The femme sole thing seems to me to be absolutely fundamental to understanding Margaret's attitude towards the rest of her life. This may be partly that so far she had exercised horribly little control over her life, or indeed it could be that she had tried very hard to exercise control on occasion and found the situation, after the Buckingham Rebellion had failed, personally humiliating. Is it possible to be cross and not being executed because you're not seen as legally responsible? But the real thing, I think, is that Margaret Beaufort considered herself to be a queen in every way, and that she should be not only in control of her own destiny, but in control of her community's destiny as a natural leader of society. After all, her claim to the throne was stronger than that of her sons. There is no prospect in which Margaret would have asserted her rights over her sons, given everything her life had been about, and what the politics of that would have been. But nonetheless, she felt her lineage in her very water. I wonder in this what Thomas Stanley thought, Mr. Margaret Beaufort, that is. You might well say, well, who cares, but it might have been hard for him to live with. Or maybe not. Margaret was now the king's mother, so with or without the fam sol thing, she had the superior social status to her husband, and precedence really mattered back then. Precedence mattered in spades, with brass shiny knobs on. But Margaret's new legal status resulted also in a detailed arrangement with Stanley about how much of his wife's income he would now get, which was between one third and two thirds of Margaret's existing estates, but absolutely zip of any grants made to Margaret since 1485. From Henry's point of view, this approach had a triple benefit. He was already in the process of rewarding Stanley anyway, and he had no desire to give him even more through Margaret. It meant that his grants to Mum now would go straight to her. And it meant that, longer term, any grants to Margaret would not be alienated permanently from the crown, because when she died, they'd then revert to the crown. The grant to Margaret came in the Great Grant of 1487, so it took a couple of years to come through. The substantial estates she received generated additional income of over £1,000 a year, which lifted her total income in 1488 to £2,000, which put her up with the richest magnates in the land. And the grants were concentrated in the West Country, and, most importantly, in the Midlands, where Henry would have plans for his mother. This, of course, was no more, surely, than just desserts for Margaret, payback time. But just before you break out into cheers, start scattering the confetti and hang out the bunting on the Siegfried line, there is just a soupçon of a hard edge. Margaret's benefit in terms of grants came at the expense of others who had been hoping for royal favour. One notable example of this is the Marquis of Dorset, Elizabeth Woodville's son by her first marriage, who had wobbled and tried, though failed, to leave the Tudor camp at Brittany. He was now suspect and would not really be trusted by Henry before his death in 1501. As with a few things with Margaret, it is important at all times to remember that she is no pushover. Anyway, Margaret had been fully enflushed and was ready to join her son at court. And there, another important figure was to join them. Henry had adopted the policy of marriage to Elizabeth of York at Margaret's suggestion, and now, in a rather obvious piece of theatre, at the end of Parliament, Henry was begged by his people to marry her. To everyone's amazement, not. He graciously accepted. Wow. Elizabeth of York and Henry Tudor were joined in holy matrimony, and therefore brought to a close the antagonism, and everyone lived happily ever after. Well, not exactly, but it was a start. Henry had really fallen on his feet in his bride. I mean, it's always difficult to be sure at such a distance, and the sources aren't exactly as you'd like. No one found Elizabeth's Dear Diary entries for 1486, for example. But by your actions ye shall be known, or whatever it is. And Elizabeth showed herself generous to her sisters, for example, fulfilled all the roles with grace associated with queenship. She was traditionally and more than adequately pious, and although the evidence of a political role is a bit limited, there are some examples. It was Elizabeth to whom a Welsh tenant appealed over an injustice involving Jasper Tudor, for example, and Elizabeth responded with a firm letter to Jasper, which, given the regard in which he must have been held by Henry, shows some confidence by Elizabeth in her own position. Henry's accounts show frequent gifts to his wife. There's no suggestion of any mistresses on Henry's part, which wouldn't have been unusual at all for royalty of the time. Overall, from all we can see, it appears as though the relationship between Elizabeth and Henry was one of genuine affection. I say all this as a precursor to the critical debate which we must follow, of course. Was Margaret Beaufort, I ask you, the mother-in-law from hell, or was she not? That is the question we must answer. What is very clear is that Margaret was very active indeed at court from the very beginning. And just to re-emphasise the point, she had a super close relationship with her son and would retain influence consistently throughout their lives. Let me quote you a few lines from Henry from a rare surviving letter, though you do need to bear in mind that flowery was definitely a la mode at the time. "I shall be as glad to please you as your heart can desire it, and I know full well that I am as much bounden to do as any creature living for the great and singular motherly love and affection that it hath pleased you at all times to bear towards me." Lord knows what my mother's reaction would be to such a letter from me. So, Henry felt an obligation towards Margaret. He trusted her advice. He respected her judgment. Contemporaries noted that the sense of obligation was a lever that the quick-witted could lean on. Or, so more than one request for favours to Henry included a reference to previous aid given to his mother, knowing that Henry saw this as an obligation to be honoured. John Hussey, for example, related that, "I came first to my lady your mother's service, which was in the second year of your most noble reign." There's a practical side to this too. Knowing the quality of his mother's household, previous service there was a strong recommendation, and Henry was not averse to a bit of headhunting, such as William Bolton, employed by Henry VII to create the rather lovely oriel window at St Bartholomew's in London. He had previously worked for Henry's mother on her house at Cold Harbour. Henry showered goodies on his mother, as we've seen, in the form of grants of land and wardships and favours such as making her a femme sole, no doubt at her request. He would constantly emphasise her status. This might be obliquely and favour his position too, such as the active rehabilitation of the Beaufort name, emphasising both of their legitimacy and adopting their portcullis symbol, amongst other things. In 1488, she was invested with the livery of the Order of the Garter. This was unusual for a woman, though not extraordinarily so, but Henry discontinued the practice, emphasising the status conferred on his mother thereafter, and the practice was not revived for women until 1901. Margaret kept Henry close, and unusually so. Contemporaries remarked on the frequency with which Margaret accompanied the King and Queen on their royal progresses, for example. In 1492, the royal party with Margaret went to view the work on St George's Chapel in Windsor. 4 years later, the royal party toured Margaret's estate in the southwest. In the 1498, the itineraries of both Margaret and her son survive, and good golly, they were together a lot. In July, they were together at London, Westminster, Sheen, and Windsor. In August, they went for a tour of the eastern counties. Ended up in September at Margaret's palace at Colley Weston in the Midlands. And indeed, when later, after 1499, Margaret withdrew to Colley Weston to operate what was effectively her own court, she made sure that not only were a suite of rooms maintained for the Queen, but that the deer park was maintained so that her son could come and enjoy the hunting as he pleased. She informed her keeper of the park that "the said deer and game to be reserved and kept for the king's pleasure and ours against such season as we shall repair unto these parts." Her house was always to be immediately available for the son's pleasure. The favour was lovingly returned. A suite of rooms was maintained for Margaret's use in all the royal palaces. And not just any old rooms, sort of close to the loo, that sort of thing. They were rooms close to the king so that his ear was always available. And, it must be said, her advice was always available. Again, advice that he knew would be designed to further his best interests. So at Woodstock, the king and mother's chambers were linked by a withdrawing chamber. That belongs to the king's chamber and my and his mother's. So on the mother-in-law question, one thing is clear. Elizabeth would certainly have seen plenty of her mother-in-law. Nor was Margaret in any way a cipher at court, ornamental. The old trout parked in the corner and kept quiet, no indeed. She was instead at the centre of both court life and cultivated a semi-regal aura and precedence in procedures and ceremonies to match. Elizabeth had been finally crowned in 1487. Henry had been careful to leave her coronation to be well after and separate to his, just so that everyone knew that it was quite clear that his legitimacy did not rest on his marriage, all right? Margaret was a very visible and regal presence at the event. The Queen kept her estate in the Parliament chamber, and my lady, the Queen's mother, sat on her right-hand side. The daughter, born to the royal couple in 1489, was named after Margaret. At the Christmas court of 1487, Margaret was observed wearing, like mantle and surcoat as the Queen, with a rich coronal on her head. Now, I suppose this could have been done in agreement, but it looks rather as though Margaret was making a point about her status, and it's quite clear that Margaret was in no way shy about how high that status was. In 1498, for example, Margaret changed her signature to Margaret R from Margaret of Richmond. Now, did she mean Margaret Regina, Queen Margaret? It would seem she was not prepared to go quite that far, obviously, but it seemed very likely that by using Margaret R, Margaret was perfectly happy for people to take the hint and make a mistake and get it wrong. While Margaret's portraits emphasise austerity and piety, without doubt they would have been just one part of the story. In this, Margaret is judged rather oddly in the same fashion as her son, who still has a reputation as a rather mean, miserly man. He was nothing of the sort. He loved finery and jewels, and he understood very clearly the value of display, magnificence, and entertainment. Many pageants and processions were given in his reign around public and dynastic occasions. Well, his mother was absolutely of the same mind. This is one of the highest status people in England, and she would have been failing in her responsibilities if she did not look the part, both in her clothing, in her jewellery, and in her estate. So the magnificence of her dress in the ceremonies of 1487 would not necessarily have been unusual. Her accounts bear witness to the size of her expenditure on clothes, as they do on her jewels. Many might have been a religious theme in line with her piety, such as a piece of the cross, for example. But that little bit of wood was set in gold, with pearls and precious stones. So it did both jobs, of piety and of magnificence. When she died, the plate and jewels in her possession were all totted up and amounted to over £4,000 worth, or close to £3 million in today's money. And finally, Margaret was a stickler for court ceremony and protocol. With energy and efficiency, she got properly stuck in and involved. She did not, repeat not, hang back and hide her light under a bushel. The ordinances of the royal household were revised in 1493, and it used to be thought that this was Margaret's work. The point's been made that there's no contemporary evidence that it was actually her that did it, but given Margaret's activity elsewhere, it seems likely she had some involvement. In 1503, after the death of Prince Arthur, the heir to the throne, it was Margaret who drew up detailed protocols for the funeral. The same applied to the journey of Princess Margaret to her bridegroom, James IV of Scotland. On occasion, you have to think that the presence of fingers in pies must have been a bit irritating. In 1501, in preparing for the marriage festivities of Arthur and Catherine of Aragon, Margaret prepared a list of Queen Elizabeth's household officers. Some of the names against jobs are left blank, ready to be filled in once Margaret had discussed them with her daughter-in-law. I think Elizabeth might well have felt either that she was perfectly capable of choosing her own officers, or, well, maybe she welcomed the advice. When Catherine of Aragon's household was put together, it contained several examples of overlap, where officers were working for both Catherine and Margaret. I mean, you know, helpful, or possibly creepily controlling. So where have we got to? Margaret was trusted and involved by her son in matters of policy and practicalities at court. Margaret was fully aware of her own status and her own worth, and was at pains to make sure everyone else knew it too. She was energetic and well organised. She knew she could make a practical difference, and so she did so. Almost everything she did, though, was oriented to making her family and son succeed. So, if you were Elizabeth, Queen, leading woman of the realm, you could very well find this irritating and intrusive. How do we think Elizabeth did feel about it? Well, firstly, the evidence for the prosecution. In 1498, the Spanish ambassador wrote a report back home about Henry's reign and security. This was a matter of major concern to the Catholic monarchs because they were considering whether or not to send their precious daughter Catherine of Aragon to England. And they really didn't want to land her in a fresh round of the Wars of the Roses. In the report back home, Ayala, the ambassador, had this to say about Elizabeth and her mother-in-law. "He is much influenced by his mother and his followers in affairs of personal interest and in others. The Queen, as is generally the case, does not like it." In another report, he was even blunter, remarking that Elizabeth, "She is kept in subjection by the mother of the king." The other little snippet we have is from one John Hoyk, who wrote that he had spoken with the Queen's Grace and should have spoken more with her, said Grace, had it not been for that strong whore, the Queen's mother. Which kind of suggests that, whether helpfully or not is a bit irrelevant, that Margaret was getting involved in Elizabeth's business and up her nose. Now, there are other interpretations possible of this evidence. One is that ambassadors are far from perfect commentators, being somewhat outsiders at court. And we don't know what John Hoyk was after, or his provenance. Maybe Margaret shared some crucial information that protected her daughter-in-law, and maybe that's why he was then cross. Elsewhere, there are signs that although Margaret was fully aware of her own status, she was not ignorant nor careless of the proprieties. So one famous example of this is that it was observed at one public ceremony that Margaret was once again with the King and Queen, but that she took care to walk a step behind them. She was aware of protocol, and she observed it. Other evidence points to collaboration between the two women. They both pleaded with Henry VII not to send the young Princess Margaret to Scotland for her marriage to James IV too early, fearing that James might consummate the marriage while the princess was too young. And hey, Margaret would know all about the dangers of that. They also wrote to the Spanish court together, asking that Catherine of Aragon learn French so they could talk with her when she arrived, and they jointly commissioned a book from printer William Caxton. It's been noted that Margaret was the originator of the very idea that Henry marry Elizabeth, though I don't take that as proof positive, since the reasons were no doubt practical and dynastic, not because Margaret had conceived a great passion to rescue Elizabeth. She was a tool of policy in those discussions. Finally, the evidence of friction is limited to those two examples I gave you. To the outside world, it appeared they were perfectly compatible. Thomas More, for example, wrote that they lived in peaceable accord. You would think that surely something else would have slipped out if they were in furious discontent and disagreement. Well, maybe. But again, maybe not. The early Tudor chroniclers were notorious toadies. It did not pay to diss your employers, and in that respect, Ayala had a far less incentive to lie and make things look good. It would seem to me that it would be entirely possible to be either driven up the wall by the oh-so-frequent and active presence of the mother-in-law, but equally, if you shared said mother-in-law's values and outlook, to be quite delighted at the extremely efficient, reliable and capable additional pair of hands. So it really depends a lot on Elizabeth's attitude. And the general impression of Elizabeth is one concerned with piety, with the health of the household. There remains a strong impression of gentleness, that she held her own court, of course, as queen, but it tended to be less politically oriented than Margaret's, although, as we've seen, she was perfectly capable of intervening when she thought it necessary. Historians generally appear to be very keen to clear Margaret of the mother-in-law from hell tag. I have to say, I'm pretty sure she'd have rattled my cage, but I'm not a 15th century royal, and so I am a poor judge. The evidence is very solid that Margaret was valued, trusted, active and capable. There's equally no evidence that Elizabeth of York was undervalued or prevented from carrying out her traditional role as queen. And the evidence that Margaret prevented Elizabeth from happily fulfilling her role is much thinner than that for their collaboration. So, maybe that's where we should leave it. Right, we have slipped away from the chronology, so let us for a short while return to it. What have we talked about en passant, however? We've seen Henry crowned and the winners rewarded, including Thomas Stanley, though with care to accommodate the old Edward IV Yorkists. We've seen Henry and Elizabeth married, and everyone loves a royal marriage. Even me, I am forced, reluctantly, to admit. The first challenge to the new king came swiftly. Obviously, the Yorkists and Tudor haters faced a problem in that they didn't have any obvious heirs hanging around in Brittany, but necessity is the mother of invention, and so they made one up, pretending that they had one in the Earl of Warwick, who was in fact in the Tower of London under lock and key. The bloke they had was actually called Lambert Simnel, who was crowned Edward VI in Dublin. The real mover and shaker of the affair was of the de la Poole family, the Earl of Lincoln, who had himself a distant claim to the throne. Probably, if all had gone according to plan, Lambert would quietly have been dropped down a well somewhere. But happily for Lambert, it did not come to that. Lincoln had followed the trail marked this way for Tudor haters, which led directly to the court of Margaret of Burgundy, Edward IV's sister, of whom it was said, pursued Henry with insatiable hatred and fiery wrath. So, Lincoln had managed to get some support there, and he managed to make what looked like a reasonable fist of it, capturing the glittering cosmopolis that was Doncaster. But on his way down south, he met Henry coming up north. Henry, after parading the real Earl of Warwick around London, had been at Kenilworth. In the panic about the rebellion, he'd ordered Elizabeth and Margaret to be brought to him there, since Kenilworth was one of the mightiest strongholds in the royal estate. In June 1487, Henry met the rebels in Nottinghamshire, and in a fiercely fought battle, the rebels were firmly trounced and Lincoln killed. Famously, Henry did not have Simnel dispatched to the boundary, but instead, once he'd confessed all, he put him to work in the royal kitchens. Obviously, having fake pretender and failed king killer didn't mess up his CV, which is odd, which is an interesting tip for any of you out there looking for that dream job move at the moment, and I believe Simnel went on to be a falconer. The whole period of panic, which stretched from 1486 into 1487, had another consequence. Now, Margaret has already acquired a strong reputation for looking after her own. We talked some while ago about the St. John family, and she managed to get a good marriage for her half-brother, John Wells, to one Princess Cecily, a daughter of Edward IV. She also managed to get Richard Poole, son of her half-sister Edith Poole, a grand prize too, in the form of marriage to Margaret, daughter of the Duke of Clarence, and therefore with royal Yorkist blood. Now, this has been described by Jones and Underwood as a serious political gaffe by Margaret, as the children of this marriage became a threat to the Tudor dynasty under Henry VIII. Nicola Tallis, on the other hand, defends Margaret, arguing that Margaret could not have foreseen the consequences. to which I think the rather tough idea was that Margaret of Clarence should not have been allowed to marry at all to avoid the risk completely. I leave that to you to discuss and decide on your attitude to such an idea. Meanwhile, though, just as families like these moved forward, the old guard, in some cases, really lost out, and none more so than the Woodvilles. To be fair, much of this was actually due to death. Two of Queen Elizabeth's uncles, Edward Woodville and Richard Woodville, died by 1491, and the Woodville family was largely relegated from major policy-making roles. It didn't help also that Elizabeth Woodville, the head of the family in a sense, had also hit the back of the out tray. It's an interesting story, I think, this one. In February 1487, with Lincoln fled to Burgundy and Simnel declared king in Dublin, Elizabeth Woodville was deprived of her estates and retired to Bermondsey Abbey. Ironically, or meaningfully, her estates would then form part of her daughter's marriage portion from Henry. Now, the question is, was she pushed or did she jump? It is the sort of situation you imagine Henry and Margaret would have discussed. And of course, once upon a time, Margaret and Elizabeth had been very thick, plotting and scheming to get rid of Richard III with the help of the Duke of Buckingham. But Elizabeth thereafter had seriously blotted her copybook. She had got sick of the catering and toilet facilities at Westminster Abbey and rejoined Richard's court. I'd reck a bit of a sympathy for her at this. She had to think of the position of her daughters who were rotting away in Westminster Abbey. But she also tried to get her son, the Marquis of Dorset, to desert Henry in Brittany, and he'd only been stopped by Henry at the last minute. Now that felt more actively anti-Henry. Now, there's an alternative view that Elizabeth was weary of the world of court politics anyway and chose herself to retire to Bermondsey, and it's a powerful argument. It might quite well have been really quite insufferable for her to see Margaret in her pomp, and being in a convent as a noblewoman was not a harsh life. You took your creature comforts with you, just as Eleanor of Aquitaine had done in later life. Again, we really do not know, but I think it's perfectly possible that Elizabeth Woodville was one royal queen too many in the Tudor nest. It's not a brutal amputation. She was soon back to be godmother for Henry and Elizabeth's firstborn, but amputation I suspect it was. Elizabeth died 5 years later in June 1487 at the age of 55, having become a distant though not entirely absent mother to her daughter the Queen. Her will has been seen as rather pointed. She made no reference to the King or Margaret, and wrote, "I have no worldly goods to do the Queen's grace my dearest daughter a pleasure with, neither to reward any of my children according to my heart and mind. I beseech Almighty God to bless her grace." In November 1487, after a suitable delay to make it clear that she was not the source of his legitimacy, right, everybody? Henry graciously allowed his wife, Elizabeth of York's coronation to go ahead, where, as we have heard, Margaret trod a nice line between letting her daughter-in-law have her day, but made very sure she then had her place in the sun at the post-match party. Now, you may be asking yourself what was happening in the relationship between Margaret and her husband Thomas Stanley while all this was going on, with Margaret treading the boards as being, as discussed previously, now the superior in status. We continue to be not very clear about how close the relationship between Stanley and Margaret was, but I'm going to push the boat out and say it remained perfectly amicable, but no great passion, and far from the most important relationship in Margaret's life by this stage. In the early years of the reign, while Stanley had seen his wife declare independence as a femme sole, nonetheless they collaborated. Margaret continued to visit and stay at Latham and Knowsley, Stanley's main seats. In 1497, when Stanley's eldest son, Lord Strange, died, they worked to set up Stanley's grandson, the next heir, in marriage to Elizabeth Wells, one of Margaret's relatives, of course, although Elizabeth's death nixed that idea. The relationship also survived the next shock, the treachery of William Stanley, Thomas's younger brother, in 1495. There's some background to this, of course. In 1490, another pretender had appeared in Ireland to challenge Henry's throne. His name was Perkin Warbeck. And once again, in the absence of proper claimants to the throne, he claimed to be Richard, Duke of York, one of the princes in the Tower that might possibly, perhaps, maybe have been done away with by their uncle. Perkin did not attempt to claim his throne immediately, but he began to build up a list of names of supporters among the disaffected of the English nobility, and one of those was William Stanley. This came as a shock when it all came out, and Henry struggled to believe it at all. And if we are to believe, and I think certainly true, Thomas knew nothing of it. William had clearly done okay from Henry's victory at Bosworth, but he'd hardly been showered with goodies and political trust, as had Thomas. And as an ambitious man, it had encouraged him to shoot his mouth off to the wrong person. Stanley was executed in February 1495. Warbeck, meanwhile, found himself support from the perfidious Scot and set up court with James IV, there to exercise a destabilising influence on Henry's reign. Nonetheless, Stanley and Margaret continued to work together, and Stanley was a regular visitor to Margaret's palace at Colley Weston, hunting in the surrounding park. But in 1499, Margaret's priorities became clearer when she took a vow of chastity. Now, it seems a reasonably open and shut case. Surely you couldn't have a more obvious rejection. Fam sol, vow of chastity. Come on, hardly the basis for a loving relationship. But it's noteworthy that Margaret took her vow of chastity with Stanley's agreement. She didn't really need his agreement. Stanley continued to visit. There is no sign of a rift. But at best, let's say, the relationship was formally amicable. There can't really be any doubt that this was not a grande passion. When Stanley died in 1405, Margaret was not with him. Stanley did not name her as an executor of his will. The forms of mourning were properly observed, and a requiem mass was held at Stamford with Stanley's grandson. But it was the proper observance of forms. Margaret had effectively moved on from this relationship emotionally some time ago. While this was going on, Henry's search for security continued. With Perkin still being supported by the Scots, and indeed married in Scotland, he had to scotch, the plotting emanating from Burgundy, and build a network of international allies to make himself safe. In this, Henry was, by his death, really pretty successful. A brief military expedition to France, supported by a healthy £1,000 contribution from his mum, had resulted quickly in a treaty. In 1497, an embassy to Burgundy had actually delivered the goods of normalised relationships, despite the relentless antipathy of Margaret of Burgundy. Margaret Beaufort wallowed in the success of this embassy and exchanged letters with the Earl of Ormond, the chief negotiator, who sent her a gift of gloves, which she wrote back were, "Right good, save they were too much for my hand. I think the ladies in that part be great ladies all, and according to their great estate, they have great personages." Which was a rather cumbersome joke to suggest Margaret of Burgundy was too grand for her own good, or as big in frame as her bloated opinion of herself, or simply a bit of a porker. Anyway, it's an insult. Meanwhile, discussions went on with the Spanish monarchs, Isabel and Ferdinand, to forge an alliance that would influence English history pretty deeply through the marriage of Prince Arthur with Princess Catherine of Aragon. Success in this negotiation would surely build the legitimacy of the Tudor dynasty, the prestige and the security of Henry's England. Within a couple of months, however, further trouble hit the reign with the rebellion in Cornwall, which itself was partially a result of the insecurity in which Henry VII's reign still languished. Taxes had been raised to allow preparation to be made for any dissent by Perkin Warbeck and the Scots, and the result were peasant riots and protests, and a substantial force of rebels marching from Cornwall to ask their king for redress. And they got close, all the way to Blackheath, just outside London. There they were finally met by the Earl of Oxford and defeated, but it had once more been a close-run thing. And Margaret noted the victory jubilantly in her Book of Hours. Later that very year, in September, the Corns were back. Warbeck had made his bid for the throne, encouraged by James IV, who was beginning to run out of patience with his guest. The timing was awful, of course, in landing in Cornwall. The force he managed to raise slowly disintegrated, and Warbeck was captured at Bewley in Hampshire. Perkins's fate was harder than Simnel's. Although initially kept at court and treated very well, his presence was too disturbing to the Spanish ambassadors with whom they were negotiating about a marriage. And eventually Perkin was encouraged to try to escape, captured, imprisoned, and executed in November 1499. 1499 then came close to giving Henry's reign and the anxiety of his mother relief at last. And its sign was the betrothal of Catherine of Aragon and Prince Arthur, by proxy, on the 19th of May, 1499. Through this betrothal, Henry and his mother had passed a significant milestone. They'd been accepted by a leading European kingdom as stable and important enough to receive the gift of their precious daughter and to be an ally for the long term. The ship of state seemed at last to be in the harbour. Thank you for listening, everyone, and for your comments and reviews, and most especially for your generous donations to the Anthony Nolan campaign. I will be back next week with the fourth instalment of the British Constitution and Law series. And until that point, good luck and have a great week.